And welcome to the Deep Dives podcast here on the No Ceilings NBA podcast feed. I'm your host, Nick Agar-Johnson, and back with me for another round of Deep Dives is Jam Hines. Jam, how are you doing this fine evening?
Doing great. Happy to join you tonight. It's cold evening here. We got snow here in the East Coast, but, you know, we're powering through.
Yeah, I mentioned this to you before we started recording, but I'm currently on the East Coast visiting both of my brothers who live here. And after spending the last 7 years in California, despite having grown up in New York, I am completely washed when it comes to the cold weather. So yeah, I'm doing this without the heater on in the room so that the heater is not making noise throughout the podcast. So for all of you listening, that is a sacrifice that I'm making for you, the humble listener, and for you, of course, Jam, to record this entire podcast without the heat on so you don't hear the sound of the heater banging in the background.
Brave man. We're all very thankful.
And on that note, let's get into why we're actually here today, not to hear me complain about cold weather, but to talk about your most recent article for No Ceilings NBA about Stefan Todorovic. And so I just want to start with my sort of usual question for this, which is, why did you choose to write about Todorovic for your article this week?
Yeah, so for Todorovic, I think for a lot of us, as we are getting ready to start the season and we get into the season, we're tracking guys who are standing out early. And he was one of the guys who were standing out early for me, and then someone who I've been tracking in the past. I mentioned the piece, being able to watch him at Prolific Prep during his high school career. And then, you know, he's finally been able to get his chance over at Pepperdine, and he's been absolutely hooping. And it was just time to write about him. I mean, the historic type of season he's putting on for shooters, I should say, flirting with that 50-40-90 club, and it was more than time for him to get his flowers.
Yeah, it's funny. Part of the reason that I wanted to talk about him with you for this episode was Prolific Prep is essentially in my backyard when I'm not visiting my brothers, but Todorovic was not the highlight player on any of the teams that he played for at Prolific Prep, which is, you know, on the one hand, it's rare to say for any sort of NBA caliber prospect that they weren't the best player on their high school team. On the other hand, when you play for one of the sort of top feeder schools like Prolific Prep, it's not that rare. And I mean, you know, you look at that roster from his first year in the States. I mean, Adem Bona, right? Mm-hmm. Muhammad Gay, Milos Uzan, who's, you know, fallen off a bit prospect radar wise, but certainly coming out of Prolific Prep was sort of seen as a higher caliber prospect. And, you know, it's interesting in that sense because it wasn't just at Prolific Prep where he wasn't sort of the star, right? I mean, you know, he mentioned he was a three-star, which, you know, clearly a very good basketball player, but, you know, not necessarily someone who you talk about with NBA projections mm-hmm. coming out of high school. And then, you know, struggled for a couple of years at SMU and his year at San Francisco. But this year, he's really starting to put it all together. And I sort of say all of that as a lead-in because in terms of just the sort of most basic, you know, log line description of Todorovic as a prospect, he's the kind of player that absolutely every NBA team is looking for. So, you know, it's kind of intriguing to me anyway, you know, first of all, that he was someone who, you know, again, played right in my backyard, but wasn't really the highlight player for that team, but also someone that, you know, as a sharpshooter at 6'8", right, you know, who can pass a little, that's the kind of player that every NBA team is looking for. And so, you know, it is fascinating that it took this long, but it also did sort of take this long for him to figure out enough of the basics that he could let sort of the strongest points of his game shine through. And we're seeing that this year at Pepperdine in a way that we hadn't in his previous college seasons.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. And I think for prospects like him, I really do have a little bit of an affinity and I kind of a little more biased towards one who have played a role, like a role through mm-hmm. their whole career, whether it's high school into college as well. So they have that experience playing a role. And then they get a chance to be the man. They get a chance to have that high usage. So they have both of those experiences, being able to kind of shoulder the load and being able to be a role player. So I like to have and see those type of prospects to be able to show that type of role versatility. I don't expect for him to be able to be a, you know, number one, number two, number three type of guy for any NBA team, but everything is right there for him to be a really productive role player and really someone that can do it right away because of his size and shooting.
I'm really glad that you brought that aspect up. I hope I'm not misattributing the quote here, but I remember previous conversations about Brandon Pajewski as someone who, you know, essentially said, I know what it is to be a role player, to fit in around, you know, the star talent. So, you know, when he had the ball in his hands all the time at Santa Clara, you know, it was like, okay, I know what it is to be the star, but, you know, I sort of came up the other way around. And again, I hope I'm not misattributing the quote, but I think the idea stands as a very important one to think about for prospects of, you know, there are a lot of players. And the example that I always sort of go to with this is Jimmer Fredette of, Jimmer Fredette was going to play Jimmer Fredette basketball no matter where he went. And, you know, what that meant is he was a star in college and he flamed out in the NBA pretty quickly, went over to China and became a star because he was just continuing to play the exact same kind of basketball he'd been playing his entire life. And it turns out he wasn't quite good enough to do that at the NBA level, but, you know, he's a 25, 30 point scorer who puts the ball up every time he touches it, it touches his hands wherever he went, right? And so for someone like Todorovic, it's this sort of opposite idea of like, I've already proven that I can be someone who, you know, as you mentioned, is, you know, a role player, like sort of cog in the machine type, you know, someone who can play off a star player, someone who, you know, okay, yeah, maybe you're not expecting him at any point to be a, you know, 19 and a half point scorer at the NBA level, right? But because he's shown that sort of high level shooting ability and that ability to score as sort of the lead guy, you know, it's easier to sort of imagine him being someone who knows where the star player is going to want to get the ball and knows how to be the perfect complement to that kind of player.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad that you brought up the Pods quote, because I couldn't remember exactly what it was word for word. So I appreciate you trying to get that through and remembering better than I can for sure. And I couldn't remember exactly. So that was exactly who was popping in my mind about Todorovic for sure. So I appreciate you bringing that up. And I think that's something that all prospects really can learn from.
So let's get into some of the details. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, we talked about the shooting, but shooting is something that I think it's very easy to sort of talk about in the large scale. And, you know, you do have to sort of break down the details of it, right? You know, there are players who are great standstill shooters, but don't do well off movement. There are players who are exceptional off the dribble scorers who, you know, if you leave them alone in the corner, you know, maybe they're not used to shooting from the corner because they're used to having the ball in their hands. They're, you know, much better, you know, at the top of the break or off the wing, but, you know, can't really quite be sort of a spot up corner guy. And the thing with Todorovic is that he kind of checks all of those boxes. And, you know, the off the dribble sample size isn't quite as large as, you know, the catch and shoot stuff, but it's the kind of thing where it's not just, okay, you know, he's someone who, I mean, you know, the sort of prototypical example is Steve Novak, right? Of, you know, all he would do is he would, you know, he would hit trail threes in transition because he was not running with anybody else in transition. And, you know, he would spot up on the wing and when, or in the corner, and when the ball got kicked to him, he'd put it up and it'd probably go in because he was a spectacular shooter. But, you know, I use Troy Daniels as an example of how the kind of player who essentially can only be a catch and shoot threat is they've been phased out of the league over the last 5-10 years. And, you know, there's sort of an element of you have to do a little bit more than just be a shooter, but it's more complicated than that because it's not just, oh, you know, he's a great shooter, right? It's you have to be a great shooter in a bunch of different ways because you're not, especially if you're not, you know, the star player, you're not just going to get to pick and choose your spots because you have the ball in your hands all the time, right? It's like, okay, how can I figure out a way to get to a shot that's good and to be able to run off movement, to be able to, you know, occasionally pull up yourself when the defense gives you that opportunity. That I think it's a lot different of a conversation as a shooter rather than just, oh, you know, he's someone who can be a great standstill spot up shooter. You know, that's nice, but it's not enough anymore. And Todorovic has enough versatility to his shooting that it's sort of easier to imagine him fitting into a larger offensive context rather than just, okay, I guess we park him in the corner.
Absolutely. Like you hit it right there in the head. Like you have to have this both shooting versatility and shot making versatility. Be able to run around screens, navigate those to get free for shots. You have to be able to hit them on trails, spot up, catch and shoot, shot fakes. You have to have all this different type of versatility within your shooting to be able to make it at the NBA level. And then for him to be able to do it at 6'8", it's just like, wow. Like, it is everything that you want, size and shooting, and things that NBA teams constantly are looking for and will gladly put whatever resources they can, especially with someone like Todorovic, who is on the margins right now. We'll see what happens when we get towards the end of the year. But when you're really around 50, 40, 90, it's such a great bet at 6'8" shooting at at that type of clip. And I think we'll see what happens in conference, but I think he'll be still flirting right around that range once we get to the end of the season. And if that happens, I really do believe he's someone that can get into that top 60 mix because of the shooting and the size we're talking about.
And it's one of those things where, you know, we'll break down some of the other elements of this later on in the podcast, but, you know, it's asinine to sort of drill in entirely on the height, but it's also, you know, Maxwell has his conversation about, you know, how small guards are sort of getting phased out of the NBA. And that's, you know, one thing where it's like, it's great to have positional size, but yeah, once you hit the sort of 6'8", 6'9" range, that's the kind of situation where, you know, okay, rather than having to be a wing, rather than being required to be a wing, you could in theory be sort of a bigger forward. And, you know, again, the sort of Ryan Anderson stretch four types of the world have been phased out a bit, but that's really just the fours who couldn't do anything else. And, you know, when you're 6'8" and you could potentially be a wing, but also potentially be a four, you know, there's a lot more, I talk about this all the time on here, sort of avenues to playing time, right? Of, you know, there are only so many lineup contexts where a 6'1" guard is going to get playing time, no matter how good they are. And, you know, we've seen this with how, you know, early on in the season, Rob Dillingham really struggled to get minutes for the Minnesota Timberwolves. You know, part of that is ironic because he was behind Mike Conley, who's even smaller guard, but, you know, Mike Conley is an all-star, you know, established veteran. And obviously this year he's fallen off a bit, but, you know, it's the kind of thing where, again, if you're a guard who's 6'4" and under, you're only playing point guard these days, right? Mm-hmm. Like you're not running out. I mean, other than maybe CJ McCollum, who is sort of a combo guard anyway, like smaller guards, your opportunities to playing time, essentially you're going to be one of the guards, right? At minimum. Whereas if you're 6'8", there's a lot more sort of room to maneuver for, okay, you know, maybe we play him as the four in a smaller lineup, right? Maybe, mm-hmm. you know, certainly for the Cleveland Cavaliers, he could be a two because of how much size Cleveland yep. has, right? You know, there's, yep. there's a lot more flexibility when you're 6'8" in terms of ways that you could earn playing time in an NBA lineup than there is if you're even 6'6", you know, much less sort of a smaller guard.
Yeah, there really is. And that's one of the reasons why I just love that marriage of size and shooting for prospects. And I think that maybe could be a weakness of mine that I could have some tunnel vision for and blind spots with. But when you talk about someone like Todorovic, pass, dribble, shoot, wing, that everyone's looking for. And when he's able to do what he does out of pick and roll, being able to show some secondary stuff as well, and these other elements, and showing that he's, you know, more than the shooters you always want to look for than for these type of guys, being able to be run off the line, make a play for others, whether it is driving kicks, drop offs, being able to read the second level of the defense as well. So it's a lot more than just the shooting, but it certainly starts with the shooting. And I just love his ability to be able to work off of that shooting threat too.
So I do want to focus on the passing in a moment, but mm-hmm. it wouldn't be me if we didn't at least spend a decent chunk of the podcast talking about his cutting strength. And
yes,
that's, I think, a huge one because, you know, again, it's the sort of role player element, right? Of, okay, you don't have the ball in your hands. What are you going to do to contribute positively to the offense? And, you know, that's, I think, where, you know, a lot of the conversation about sort of quote unquote pure shooters gets bogged down in terms of their NBA translation is, you know, again, unless you're the star player, right, you're not going to have the ball in your hands every possession. You're not going to have the ball in your hands most possessions, even with sort of a heavy ball movement type offense that Pepperdine has, that certain NBA teams have, right? Like, certainly the Kings have that kind of offense. Certainly the Warriors, mm-hmm. you know, most famously have that kind of offense, right? But even for those kinds of teams, you know, you can't rely on being able to have the ball in your hands at some point on every possession. But, you know, a way you can take advantage of defenses is, okay, you know, you're going to sag off me a little bit because you don't expect the ball to swing my way, right? But you're going to close out hard on a three-pointer. If you just cut around the guy, all of a sudden that opens up a lot of offensive avenues for you as a shooter if you can make defenses pay for, you know, ignoring you, even if it's just only for a split second, right? You know, oh, guy gets caught ball watching, you back cut him, and all of a sudden that's an easy basket that, you know, again, I think it's valuable for pretty much all NBA players to have that element at least a little bit. And granted, I'm a sucker for guys who are really good cutters, so, you know, that's one of my personal biases, right? But with someone who's a shooting threat like Todorovic, that's really the easiest way to say, okay, I'm an off-ball player for the most part. What do I do to make myself a problem for defenses when I don't have the ball in my hands? I cut. You know, I put pressure on the rim by, you know, forcing guys to pay attention to me, not just when I'm behind the 3-point line, but, you know, also when I'm motoring my way to the basket.
Absolutely. And it's a good chance when he cuts, he can he can relocate, pop out again for three.
Yeah,
when
for sure.
When he cuts, kick it out again, do lots of different things. And the timing that he's shown with cuts, the comfort level of being able to, when he's navigating screens with these curling, to be able to fake, to flare, go back into a cut as well too. So I really like the way he's able to read and react. I want to see more of that, as I mentioned in the piece as well. But he's so great at being able to do that within the structured offense. Like you already mentioned, several NBA offenses, including the Kings, your beloved Kings, mm-hmm. have these type of offenses with ball movement where there is a lot of off-ball screening and a focus on cutting and passing or place and those type of things. So I think when he comes into the NBA, well, hopefully he was the NBA player. I do think he is. But when he's on NBA floor, he has that comfort level and understanding of how to operate within sets and do a lot of the things that are going to be required of him already.
So let's talk about some of the playmaking stuff. And I'm just going to sort of mention the finishing numbers that you put in the piece, because I think they're relevant here. But I am curious sort of your thoughts on his playmaking more generally. But yeah, it's the kind of thing where, as you say in the piece, he's comfortable attacking closeouts. He makes good decisions for the most part. And despite the fact that he's not the greatest athlete, I mean, you mentioned he's a below the rim finisher. He has two dunks, but 67% at the rim on 61 attempts is more than good enough for the kind of player he is, at least in my mind. And so, you know, again, it's the similar sort of idea with, you know, making defensive play with cutting when you're off the ball, right? It's also, you know, if you are this kind of shooter, more and more NBA teams are requiring you to be able to, at least at a basic level, attack a closeout, right? You know, you don't have to be Amen Thompson attacking the basket, but, you know, Thompson can't shoot at all, which is, you know, part of the problem there, right? But, you know, you have to at least be able to make defenses not just entirely sell out to, okay, he's the shooter on the floor, you know, just make sure he doesn't get to shoot, right? You have to be able to attack a closeout at least some level. And, you know, again, I'm curious your thoughts on the playmaking side of it, but certainly in terms of at rim finishing, 67% is more than good enough in my book to sort of look at that number and say, okay, I doubt he finishes at that, you know, clip at the NBA level, but, you know, even him finishing at 60% clip around the rim at the NBA level, given his shooting touch, that's really all he needs to do. And so the fact that he's been doing that this season is very encouraging for me in terms of the sort of nebulous other elements to his offense.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. And that number at the rim really surprised me. I got into the rim numbers after watching the film. And I was like, oh, okay, this kind of does match when he does get there. He is finishing. He is crafty. He is 6'8". There is some touch there. He has some step-throughs and Euros when he gets there. So, like you said, he's not Amen Thompson. He's not Ja Morant. He's not this like, explosive type of athlete. which is fine. But when the numbers are there and you're crafty and you're 6'8", I expect for him to at least be a serviceable type of rim finisher. Doesn't have to be anything fancy, but like you're saying, when you run off the line, when you're cutting, when the opportunity presents itself, you have to be able to score at the rim. And when he compare that with what he's able to do as a playmaker, and you know, kind of combine and not compare, but you combine that with his playmaking ability when he's ran off the line and running pick and roll as well. There's really a lot to like about kind of the overall connective nature that he brings as a shooter and a passer. And that's exactly what you really want from a role player. I want to see more of kind of reading the second and third levels of the defense out of pick and roll. But then when I really think about it, it's like, that's more of a luxury. Does he really need to be doing that? Like, you know what I mean? So I think there's more of kind of a nitpicking things more I want to see, but not really required or is really going to really affect his production and his effectiveness really at the next level, especially from a floor perspective.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think there's, you know, I sort of think of it in terms of three sort of tiers of passer, where the first tier is, can you make the basic sort of connecting reads? And then the second level is, can you be sort of, you know, a quote unquote caretaker point guard type of, you know, you're good enough as a passer to run the offense, but you're not at what I think of as sort of the third level, which is sort of the more Nikola Jokic, Trae Young, LeBron James level of passing guys open, you know, rather than just hitting the passing windows, rather than just running the pick and roll at an incredibly high level, the ability to, you know, pass your teammates into good looks, just, you know, purely essentially creating that look by yourself as a playmaker. And, you know, really for the kind of player that Todorovic is, I think he only needs to reach the first level. You know, as you mentioned, it'd be great if he can reach the second level and you could say, okay, all of a sudden we have this sort of jumbo point guard type, you know, running the offense off the bench, you know, being more than just sort of a secondary, tertiary playmaker type. But, you know, as you mentioned, when you have all the other connective elements that he has, really, I think all you need with the passing is just, are you a willing passer and do you make the basic passes, right? Do you, you know, hit the next, you know, do you hit the next guy open, you know, sort of rotating the ball around the arc, right? It's the basic sort of level of that where, you know, again, I'm saying basic, but there are plenty of players who don't hit even that level, right? Of, you know, we call them black hole type players for a reason, right? They just, you know, they get the ball and all of a sudden it's like either it's going up or it's going the other way on a turnover, right?
And it's maddening.
Yeah. And for Todorovic, it's like, okay, you know, would it be nice if he was someone who could, you know, run a pick and roll at a really high level? Yeah, that'd be great. But all he really needs to do is just make the swing pass when the opportunity arises and be willing to make that swing pass. And the willingness and the ability is really the important part. And that I think he has down. And again, you know, that would definitely, I think, be the next sort of step for him in terms of if he gets to a higher level as a player, is that sort of playmaking element. But as long as he hits that basic level, especially given the rest of his game, I think that's good enough.
Yeah, it certainly is. And if he's in the G League, I would imagine that's something that they will hopefully will allow him to really work on. But it's not something that's really, like you're saying, is really needed for him at the next level. And then I don't want to kind of stereotype European players, but it's a positive stereotype here, though. But just, you know, that level of feel that they typically always have, I mean, it just pours right into his connective type of game with the passing and the cutting as well. And that's it. I just can't get enough of the feel and the overall type of connectivity he has to his game.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit simplistic, but, you know, when you're this kind of player, you can't be making bad decisions, right? And, you know, there's a world of difference between don't make bad decisions and make good decisions. And I think he's more on the make good decision side than the don't make bad decision side. But really, that's sort of the main thing is, you know, given how much he has the ball in his hands this season for Pepperdine, again, that's not going to be the case at the NBA level, barring some sort of insane breakout, which, hey, you know, we say no ceilings, right? We can't really say that it's impossible that he gets there. But, you know, that's like a 99th percentile outcome. Like the odds of him being more than a role player are extremely slim. The flip side of that is when you have the connective feel that he has, and you have the finishing ability at the rim that he has, and you have the not only the shooting touch that he has, but the versatility of the shooting that he has, the floor is pretty high. You know, there are a lot of NBA teams that could use, again, we're talking in theory, right, as we always are for draft prospects before they reach the NBA level, but in theory, he has all the offensive elements you could want for a player of his archetype.
Yeah, and this name just popped in my mind. I know a lot of us don't believe in one-on-one comps. I'm not in that type of camp either. But just as you described, when we talked about his game, Baylor Shireman kind of pops into my mind. Just me talk about a guy who can run and pick and rolls, has the connective passing with you as well. He can rebound. The playmaking, obviously, the main calling calls is the shooting. You know, at six, well, he's taller than Baylor, but, you know, you have the wing size and not being a great athlete, but having that feel and just the effort and the size defensively to kind of compensate while you do your thing on the offensive end. So not a one-to-one comp, but that type of player just popped in my mind as you talked about him.
Yeah, that would be a great. I certainly see the comp there. I think, you know, the plus for Todorovic is the size. I think the downside is just he doesn't quite have the same shooting history that Shireman does, right? I mean, you know, we're talking about him as a breakout guy this year, and it's one of those things where, you know, I tend to get wary when a guy has a breakout 3-point year if it's not at least accompanied by other touch indicators. And I've called myself a partial free throw truther many times. I might have said that with you on the previous recording. If I haven't, I've said it now, right? And the fact that he's, you know, in the 90 range free throw wise at least tells me, okay, this is someone with good touch who, you know, finally is in a good situation, right? But I'm more wary of sort of shooting regression from guys who don't have that long of a track record. But, you know, again, As I said earlier, right, the difference between 6'6 and 6'8 in terms of avenues to playing time is it can be pretty significant. But that kind of leads into the area that we do have to discuss here, which is the defense. And you put it, I think, the best way that we can in the header for the article. So I'm just, or for the header for that section. So I'm just going to read that. Is there defensive value or at least a net neutral path? And look, that's, you know, it's funny because when I think of, you know, the main sort of areas where we see athleticism come to bear, it's at rim finishing and defense. And he makes up for a lot of his weaknesses in terms of athleticism as a finisher around the basket, but defensively not so much.
Yeah, and that is the big kind of red flag here, if you will, because of the athleticism, the lateral quickness isn't there. There's not a lot of vertical explosiveness, not a lot of fluidity in the hips. It's not bad, but the change of direction of fluid to be able to flip his hips isn't great. So it's just really about using the tools that he does have, and that's the size, the length, and the feel. And one of the clips that I put in there for his defense was the play that he had against Gonzaga where he plays to and helps. So doing those type of things is what I want to continue to see him do and put on film. And I wish there was a little bit more of an element of playmaking, defensive playmaking to him to kind of like compensate. It's like it's where you can be like, oh, well, he's going to struggle defensively kind of guarding on the ball. But he does have this disruptive aspect to his game. There's some quick hands, but that's just not really where he's at. So I just want to see him continue to be in the right positions, rotate correctly, being helped, continue to give that effort with size. And for me with defense, especially when you're more of an offensive player, but if you have size and you give effort, like I feel like teams should be able to work with that. You're 6'8" and you try, like you're busting your butt to make rotations, you're closing out, you're making hustle plays. Like give me that at size, and you know, with that size. And I think you can teams can work with that.
Yeah, there are two great points there that I want to circle back to. First of all, yeah, I mean, so much of defense is effort, right? And, you know, when you, as you say, when you have the size that he does and you're actually putting in the effort on the defensive end, that goes a long way, you know, and it doesn't necessarily go far enough for him to be particularly fantastic at it. But yeah, I mean, it's the kind of situation where, again, you know, when you have the level of effort that he does and the size that he does, you can make up for a lot of other sort of issues.
Absolutely. It's just, you're 6'8". You have that type of size. I understand if you're, when you're limited athletically, but it's just really about effort. Control what you can control and use what you have. That's the size, that's the length, and that's your effort. And just hope that that will be enough to maintain and help in the team scheme defensively while he does this thing offensively. Because it's not going to work if he's shooting like 25% and that's the defense right. that he's given, you know. But if he's shooting 38, 40%, and he's active defensively, he's in the right spot, he's going to get picked on sometimes. But if you're still scoring, you're giving that effort, you're making it at least a competitive defensive effort, I think teams will be more than fine with that.
And, you know, it sort of goes back to the avenues to playing time discussion that we were having earlier of, look, he Todorovic is going to earn his minutes with his offense, right? He's not going to, you know, be a Keon Ellis, right, who, you know, makes his way into the lineup and then inexplicably leaves the lineup and then reenters the lineup after the firing of Mike Brown. But that's a different story. But, you know, with Todorovic, right, he's not going to be someone who, okay, you know, he's our defensive stopper, right? We're throwing him out there to, you know, guard the best forward on the other team. But given that the way that he's going to earn his playing time and earn his theoretical NBA spot is going to be with his offense, again, it's really just, as you mentioned, you know, can he get to, you know, net neutral or below average rather than bad, rather than like the guy that gets picked on, can he at least be, you know, participating in a scheme? And that's, you know, where the effort thing is like, okay, you know, where, you know, the concern of him not trying very hard is not as large of a concern. You know, there's only so much he can do to make up for. And that was the other point that you made earlier that I wanted to circle back to. Very important to sort of break down athleticism in the same way that we broke down shooting of some guys are very quick laterally, but don't have that vertical explosiveness. Some guys the other way around. Todorovic kind of has neither. The verticality, he can at least make up for a bit by being big. The lateral quickness is a bit more of a problem, especially given that, you know, he's probably going to be asked to switch a decent amount just because most NBA teams switch a decent amount these days. And yep. if you're not sort of a drop center, you're going to be asked to switch a little bit, which, you know, maybe he gets picked on a bit. But again, as long as the effort's there, it's not going to be as big of a problem as it would be with a player who's either smaller or doesn't give the same level of effort.
Exactly. That's why I'm not too hung up on the defense. Like, I think we all kind of know what it is. It's offense first, survive defensively with the tools that you do have. And I do believe that a lot of NBA teams are really looking for, can you shoot the ball with some type of size and we can work with you defensively within the scheme? Or can you really defend and we can teach you how to shoot, or at least you to a serviceable level, even if you aren't going to be this high-level shooter? So I think those are kind of the extremes that teams, especially when you are talking about wings, which are so valuable, I think that's kind of the kind of extremes that both of the extremes that teams are looking for.
All right. Anything else on Todorovic before we move on to our final topic of the day?
Just last thing about him. I just really hope he is someone that does get an invite to the Portland Invitational. That is my favorite pre-draft event. I absolutely love that event. Always talking about it. Been going there for, over 10 years, which is kind of crazy to think about.
Oh, wow.
But I remember my first one was with Derek White's year, if I'm not mistaken. So that's kind of crazy. I think it'll be a perfect setting for him to be able to build upon his momentum and really shine in front of the NBA scouts. And I wouldn't be surprised when we come back around, you know, April, May, we were talking about Portsmouth, that he's one of the standouts there if he's invited.
That certainly hope he's invited. He's the kind of player that could have a really sort of defining performance at Portsmouth. He doesn't even need to have like a 40-point heater, right? It's just, you know, mm-hmm. get him in a room with a lot of NBA scouts who can say, oh, yeah, I can see how this guy fits on our team. Yeah, I can see how this guy, yep. you know, like just a whole room full of scouts being like, yeah, there's a path here that makes a lot of sense. So, yeah, let's hope he gets that Portsmouth invite. And, you know, we'll see if, as you mentioned, he might end up in a real conversation about being in the top 60 by the time we get around to draft night.
No doubt.
All right. So before we wrap up, I just wanted to touch on one of your buzzer beaters. And we're going in a pretty opposite direction in a number of ways to Cooper Flagg. And, you know, you sort of highlighted his performance against SMU, which I don't know how to phrase this because I don't think there were particularly doubters, quote unquote, about mm-hmm. Cooper Flagg, but there almost were doubters in a weird way about, you know, oh, is he going to be able to do enough offensively? And I have a very specific point about that, but, you know, again, it's the kind of thing where, you know, people were expecting this kind of game from Cooper Flagg. I think people who have not been familiar with Cooper Flagg before this season might have been, you know, very upset that we didn't see this kind of game from him before, you know, the back-to-back 24-point games. But yeah, I mean, it's certainly nice when, you know, again, it's weird because like the doubter chorus was both very quiet because there weren't many people saying those things, but also very loud because, wow, were they saying those things a lot. And it's nice for him to have that kind of performance. But it's interesting for me because I've pretty much viewed Cooper Flagg as in many ways, the opposite of Todorovic, as someone who earns his playing time defensively. And look, we're talking about a completely different caliber of player, right? I mean, Cooper Flagg is the number one prospect in his class. He almost certainly will go number one on draft night. You know, that's been the case essentially, you know, since he was a 17-year-old, you know, showing out for the select team against the Olympic team, right? You know, that's been locked in for him as the number one guy in this class for a while. But for me, you know, and I'm really curious your thoughts on this. I've had a number of conversations with my father about basketball, and my father is the kind of person who says Bill Russell has an argument for the best basketball player of all time.
And, I love it.
You know, it's funny because the player that I have thought about a lot when I've heard sort of the Cooper Flagg doubters this year, when he's had his worst offensive games, is this is modern day Ben Wallace. And if you're winning games 80-65, that's exactly the same as winning games 125-110, right? And if you're someone like Cooper Flagg, who, you know, again, the game was different 20 years ago when Ben Wallace was dominating, but, you know, he might have only scored 10 points a game, but he was taking 20 points off the board, right? And, you know, maybe Draymond Green is a better sort of modern example, right? But mm-hmm. when you're that special of a defensive talent, you know, only scoring 10 points a game is not the end of the world. And, you know, the fact that he's, you know, broken out and had a few 20-point games recently, you know, it sort of erases that line of conversation because he has shown that, hey, he can, you know, score at a high level too, which has been part of his game. But the driver of his game has always been the defense. And, you know, again, I go back again and again to the idea of like, look, if you're taking as many points off the board for the other team as Cooper Flagg is, that is a superstar level of, you know, contribution. It just doesn't show up in the box score. But that's why Ben Wallace is a Hall of Famer. That's why Draymond Green is going to be a Hall of Famer. And, you know, if Cooper Flagg averages 12 points a game next season, he could still be, you know, the best rookie, you know, player, even if Dylan Harper's averaging 18, right? Because the impact that Cooper Flagg has defensively is special. And I'm glad that, you know, the doubters are sort of coming around now that he's scoring at a higher level, but it was never about that for me.
Yeah, you are preaching to the choir. Like, I could not agree more. It's been really, well, a lot of the discourse in general with in the draft community has been pretty strange with certain prospects, but with Cooper, yes. It's like he's kind of talked about like he is not a zero offensively, but let me frame it like this. I just feel like because he is not this breakdown isolation, it's going to look very, very pretty. I'm going to blow by guys and just create very easily one-on-one. he's not that type of offensive player, at least right now. And I think that's what a lot of people, as you should, look for in that first pick. But there's just a lot of qualities that go into getting that first pick. It is not just all offensive being the number one option at hub, which is great. You know, Anthony Davis got drafted. Of course, we saw that that he had the potential to become a number one, but it was defense first. It was him being the anchor of the defense, whether if he's going to average 15, 16 points per game, but it's going to be him being a perennial defensive player of the year. For whatever reason, he can't get. I don't know what's going on in NBA voters and writers. I'm a Lakers fan. I'm a little upset about that. So, but like he definitely deserves more love for defensive player of the year. But with Cooper, like you said, a special defensive player, he's going to be a perennial all NBA type of defender. He's going to be able to defend different positions. I mean, another time and go in exactly what that looks like. But for the sake of time, just him be able to defend multiple positions, defensive playmaker, what he does defensively, and he's still a good offensive player. And then going back before he gets to Duke, we saw his development. Well, some of us saw his development on the grassroots level, becoming a more confident and advanced offensive player. So he's just a couple years into really becoming a really advanced offensive threat with the step backs, the spins, and like these type of things. The offensive game is still growing, and this is what he's doing already. He's not at his evolved form, if you will, if I can steal something from Pokemon. Like he's not always
Pokemon references are welcome on the Deep Dive Podcast.
he's not there. He's not even close to being that. And if you know and see what he's doing defensively, what he can do offensively, there's still so much more upside for him to tap into as a two-way guy, which is why he is my number one overall prospect. And I don't see that changing. I think Dylan's right there. He still has a case to an extent. But I think he still has a stranglehold on that first pick for me. And it's going to be very, very tough for him to relinquish that in my eyes unless it just goes very, very south, which I don't see happening. Even if he is, you know, shooting still below 30% from three, or the case it could be, I'd buy in the overall shot making and the confidence. And he's not afraid to shoot them. He will shoot them and make them in big moments, you know. So I'm not worried at all about his offense.
And, you know, it's funny because I know for a fact that I have said before on this here podcast that it's unfair to compare prospects to Draymond Green, but I mean, Cooper Flagg's playmaking, his passing is exceptional, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, okay, maybe, you know, even if he shoots sub 30%, I mean, Dylan Harper is having a spectacular year, and he's having such a spectacular year that I've, on my board, moved him into the same tier as Cooper Flagg. Yeah. Cooper Flagg is still number one on my board, and he will be number one on my board at the end of the season. But to me, it's an achievement that Dylan Harper has been so impressive that I've got them in the same sort of tier because of what Harper has shown offensively. I mean, his finishing numbers, you know, his finishing numbers are insane for, you know, the kind of player that he is. But yeah, I mean, for Cooper, it's like, look, you know, as you mentioned, he's one of the youngest prospects in this class, right? He reclassified to be in this draft. And, you know, it's funny because, you know, I'm looking back and Dwight Howard was third in rookie of the year voting his rookie year because Emeka Okafor and Ben Gordon each scored 15 points a game and Dwight Howard scored 12. Within 2 years, that looked insane. And, you know, it's the same sort of principle of Dwight Howard, you know, and it's funny because his career since then was not what people might have hoped for. But Dwight Howard in Orlando was not just incredible defensively. He's literally one of the best defensive players of all time. Like his run in Orlando was league changing, you know, not quite to the level that Shaquille O'Neal was league changing, but, you know, his defense was ridiculous. And, you know, it's the kind of thing where he managed to get to the point where he was a 20 point a game scorer. But, you know, it's funny because I'm looking at this and the year that Dwight Howard was third in rookie of the year voting, can you guess who won defensive player of the year?
Ooh, geez. I have no idea.
Ben Wallace.
Oh, well, how fitting.
Yep, exactly. And he scored just under 10 points a game. But, you know, with the, you know, incredible defense that he provided, not just, you know, in terms of deterring guys at the rim, but, you know, also just general defensive playmaking. He had a steal and a half a game in addition to 2.5 blocks a game. Just the impact that Ben Wallace had defensively was something else. And I keep going back to it every time I see questions about Cooper Flagg's offense, because it's like, if Ben Wallace can be as successful as he was while averaging under 10 points a game for some of his defensive player of the year seasons, Cooper Flagg at 13 to 15 points a game with the all-world defensive impact that he provides is going to be the number one player in this draft class for me, pretty clearly, even despite how incredible Dylan Harper has been this season.
Yeah, right there with you. You've been preaching to the choir the whole pod. And I will say this about Cooper as well. It just seems sometimes that with the offense, people are just acting like it is just so rudimentary that it's like that he's really going to struggle to score, to the point that like he is like offensive, no disrespect to these guys, but offensively they he's like Michael Gilchrist coming out, or he's like OG and Anunoby offensively coming out at that time. And he's more advanced than both of those guys offensively, but kind of the discourse is like, all right, this guy is, like you said, 12 points per game type of score. There's no chance that he can be an upper teen 20 points per game score, but I really do think he can be a high teen 20 point type of score. 25 plus, I'm not sure. You know, as you mentioned, this is no ceilings. We want to put that ceiling on him. But just as a floor, I really do see, you know, that 16, 17, 18 points per game. And especially with that all-world defense that we talked about, I'm not sure how you can go any other way unless you are very confident that another prospect is going to reach their ceiling.
Also, for reference, Cooper Flagg already has 10 more assists than OG Anunoby did in his two-year college career. Just saying.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. Anything else before we wrap this one up?
No, that's it. It's always a pleasure getting on here with you. I've been able to talk about Todorovic and Flagg, and I'm excited to be able to do this and looking forward to doing it again soon.
All right. Well, he is Jam Hines. You can find him on Twitter at Jam on the Boards, and you can, of course, find his written work at NoCeilingsNBA.com. You can find me on Blue Sky at NBAJohnson.BlueSky.social, and you can find me on Twitter, in theory, at NBAJohnson, but I'm not on there as much anymore, so if you want to hear back from me, maybe that's not the right place. If you've been enjoying the show, please take the time to leave a rating and or a review in whatever podcast player you might be using. That's always much appreciated. And if you have any feedback specifically regarding the deep dives portion of the podcast, feel free to reach out to me either via Blue Sky or email nickaj.nba@gmail.com. And as always, thanks so much for listening.